Today, we're going to be discussing Bibles. Not just the Bible, but specifically print Bibles. I think we'll leave digital Bibles for another day. But Joe, you actually just bought some Bibles. And before we get too far into this, I should mention we're not doing feedback this week. So if you left a voicemail, send us a tweet. If you're angry with us, we do apologize. We recorded this episode a little bit in advance because we wanted to make sure that we had content each week. So while this episode is a little bit old, what we're about to talk about is
older.
Evergreen is what I was going to say. It's something that, you know, people are thinking about all the time. That said, recently, for our recording date, Joe, you just bought a couple of pretty nice Bibles, and I thought we could talk about those and maybe Bible design in general. So you bought one Bible, and then you weren't very happy with that, so you were looking to return that and get another one. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's kind of how it went down. Basically, I bought two Bibles, and I bought them at essentially the same time, and I wanted to check and see which one I preferred, and then I ended up returning one of them. So I started off by buying a NIV Holy Bible, compact, giant print, premium leather, black.
Wait, can you say that again? Because that was NIV Holy. So it was Holy.
NIV Holy Bible.
All right.
Compact, giant print, premium leather, black.
All right. I think I got it.
Yeah. And that Bible uses the premium leather cover on it. It is a larger print Bible. I wanted something that you could actually set on a pulpit and read from a little bit of a distance. And I also wanted it to not be this huge, massive tome that I wouldn't carry around with me. It's something that I'd be comfortable actually using on a day-to-day basis. So I bought that one. I found that the one of the big challenges with that particular resource was it was really difficult to find online what that resource looked like, as far as like what the open Bible looks like. If you go to Zondervan's website, and full disclosure here, I work for Olive Tree Bible Software, which is a partner with Zondervan. We are both under the HarperCollins Christian Publishing umbrella there. So, but anyway, if you go to the Zondervan website and look at that Bible, it literally just shows you the cover of the printed package that
Bible
you're looking for arrives in. You don't have any clue what the inside looks like at all. I wasn't even 100% sure if it was like what the references were like or what it was going to have in there. So my first real experience with it was opening the package when it arrived.
Did you do an open, you know, an unboxing video on Periscope or anything like that?
I totally did not.
No, one of my favorite things, just to throw something in here, is one of my favorite things. I've been to a number of Bible websites where they have a PDF printout. Like, you can actually print this thing. It's going to be to scale, and you can hold this thing in your hand and know this is exactly what my Bible is going to look like. But sounds like you had nothing, not even just a picture.
Didn't even have that. Yeah, that would have been actually really helpful. So maybe we can link to something like that in the show notes when we do release this, because I think a resource like that would actually give people a sense of what that Bible is going to be like in their hands.
Yeah, and I just meant certain publishers do that. Like, I don't know if Crossway does, but I prefer the KJV, and there's a number, there's Trinitarian Bible Society or Trinity Bible Society.
Yeah, Trinitarian.
And they do a lot of PDFs of their stuff, and mm-hmm. I almost bought a Westminster Reference from them.
Yeah, but I decided not
to, because I didn't like the PDF printout.
Right. They have some really nice Bibles, actually, at Trinitarian Bible Society, and they one thing I really like about that particular resource is they are inexpensive. They actually... It basically looks like they're not trying to make much in the way of profit on those Bibles, but just mostly cover the costs of printing them and distributing them. So, yeah, I would highly recommend them if you want a KJV Bible. The main caveat there being, if you don't want a KJV Bible, you got to go somewhere else. They only do the authorized version.
Yep, yep. Although I wish they did Geneva's, because I love the Geneva translation, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah, definitely. So the other Bible that I bought was the ESV... I'm going to switch to the web page here because I have them both open on a web page just so I could reference it. It's the ESV Single Column Heritage Bible, and that's calfskin and brown is the one that I got there. Now, the difference between these two Bibles is the ESV one is about $50 more. It's a little bit more compact of the Bible, and it has become my everyday carry Bible. I have this one with me.
Everyday carry Bible.
Yeah, I put it in a bag. It's my concealed carry Bible.
That's what I call my phone, Joe.
It has really nice printing on the page, as well as they can do. They really do an excellent job of line matching between multiple pages, so you can really see that any of the bleed through that you'd get from the other pages is pretty much mitigated by the line matching.
You get to
read that and not have a bunch of funky bleed here. Now, I have a particular page open that shows poetry formatting and prose formatting on the single page, and there you do see some bleed through, but that really, actually, the thing that I like about looking at it there is, in fact, I'll pass it over to you, Dave, you can take a look
at
it, is that you can see that how well the line matching works when you do have prose versus prose and poetry versus poetry. It's really an easy Bible to read.
That's not bad, because bleed through is one of my least favorite things. It can be incredibly distracting, and it makes sense. There's no real way to avoid it, because you've got paper that has to be thin in order for the Bible not to be 140 pounds.
Right.
Obviously, with the ESV Study Bible, that's especially important, because I think I've heard stories of people breaking their backs.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
Or their children.
We just got I just got a copy of the Zondervan Study Bible, the new study Bible that Zondervan's putting out, in the same sort of a format, that premium format. And it's really nice, but boy, that thing is a big, big brick to haul around. I just can't haul it around on a regular basis. It weighs more than my MacBook.
Which, ironically, will fit lots of ESV Study Bibles.
Oh, yeah. So, anyway, between those two, the conclusion I came to is twofold. One is the actual binding on the ESV one. These are not cheap Bibles. This is a $175 Bible. And it was a very special save-up for Christmas sort of thing to be able to do one of these two. The other one is the Zondervan one's $125, but the binding is just significantly superior on the ESV one. They just did a nicer job with it. They have leather inside and outside of the cover binding. The paper, or the NIV one, is a paper interior binding. The NIV one also came to me with some pretty significant blemishes on it. And one thing I will say, and this is not just because I work for the company, but I dealt with regular customer support like any customer would. I didn't have any special internal customer support number to call. And they were just fantastic with dealing with me on that issue with the binding having pretty big blemishes on it. They basically just took my word at it, said, okay, well, can we get you another one out today? And at that point, having actually held it in my hand, I realized the print was actually a little too big and the binding was a little too thick. So once I can save up, I am going to get a different version of it, but I know now which one I want, which is slightly smaller print and will be significantly more compact. But they were super, super helpful on that return, and they didn't fight me on it at all, which was really encouraging. And actually what they ended up saying is, I said, well, I'm actually not going to buy that one. I'm going to buy something different. Can I get this other one sent and pay the difference? Because it was a $5 difference between the two. And they said, we can't do that. You just have to reorder the other one. But they said, just keep the one that we sent you already. And they refunded my money, which was awesome.
Nice. Yeah.
So they're excellent customer support. I think the Bible's actually really nice. I'm not going to not use a Bible just because it's got a blemish cover, but I wouldn't pay $125 for a Bible that's got blemishes on it.
Sure.
Out of the box.
So we're both designers. That's the reason we're on this, designers and Christians, which is why we're talking about Bibles. But let's talk a little bit about the design aspect. So you decided to go from a giant print dual column to a single column, or was the first one single column too?
Both of these Bibles are... you mean the one that I'm going to purchase later? Is that what you mean?
You're holding a... which one are we looking at here?
This is the
single column ESV. The NIV one was a dual column, no?
It was, yeah. And it was tough to... Actually, let me take a look here real quick. Yeah, no, it was a single column. It was a big single column.
Is that something that you like? Do you think that's better for reading? I know in poetry, I like single column, but when it comes to something like Romans... dual column often has a better number of characters per line.
Yeah. Because of the size of the print that I'm looking at, I think single column works better for me.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think the font choice that was available there in this ESV Bible versus the NIV Bible that I purchased. I preferred the font choice, especially they were trying to do a giant print, but also still make it compact enough to not make the resource, make the Bible so huge in your hand.
Sure.
I thought it felt like kind of a squished font.
Yeah, it was probably one of the condensed variants, which they're using a lot in Bibles now.
Yeah.
The word that keeps coming to mind as I think through this conversation is first world problems, because, you know, here we are, you know, spending tens or hundreds, not hundreds, but, you know, upwards of $50 on Bibles and finding things to complain about. But I mean, it kind of makes sense that, you know, if you're going to spend that much money, you're going to be critiquing the Bible pretty substantially. I know for me, I'll be honest with you, I gave up on good Bible design. Like there are very few Bibles that I look at and think this was really well designed. I love everything about this. And so for me, buying an expensive Bible is kind of just a no-go at the start, because I don't think I'm going to get something that I would really like for the money. And if I'm looking for a really well typeset experience, I'm just going to use an app for that, especially, you know, where I can customize the fonts a little bit. And that's honestly just me. I know I have a couple of Bibles that I use regularly, and I really don't like the typesetting on them. I have a Geneva Bible and I have a KJV that's all right. But yeah, there's part of me that wishes there was a place where you could go and say, I want this translation, I want these notes, and I want to be able to pick how it's designed. And I realized that, like, realistically, that's impossible, like, because of just everything that would have to happen to make sure that, you know, you're not getting orphaned characters and automatic, like, you couldn't script that. That's not something that somebody could do at a computer. And then moreover, like, you're just going to get, like, what happened on MySpace with people's Bibles. Like, I just can't imagine looking at somebody in front of me, you know, at church, and they have their Bible open and it's in papyrus with Comic Sans headings and everything's on pink and it's blue text. And it's like, what were you thinking? So I guess I appreciate that. But yeah, for me, I've never found a Bible that I could love enough to spend that much money on.
Right. Yeah. And I totally understand that. I just really wanted to have a very nice Bible on hand, and I wanted it to be bound well enough and put together well enough that it's something that I could pass on to my children at some point.
Sure.
And I have wrecked multiple paper Bibles with overuse, which is a good problem to have. I'd like to have, over time, buy a couple of nice Bibles. I have 6 kids currently, and I would like to have a nice Bible to pass on to each of them. I actually have my mother's Bible, my mom's still around, but she passed this Bible to me, and it was her grandfather's Bible. So I have a really old one. It's super nice and compact, but I also want it to not want it to get wrecked anymore. But I can see the difference of having a leather Bible, a real nice premium binding, and how that makes that thing last. That Bible's over 100 years old, and it's well worn, and is still very much usable today. You know, it's got a little bit of cleanup that's had to happen, you know, taped out some pages and things like that. But anyway, so that's kind of my the method to that. I think a lot of the mid-grade Bible priced Bibles these days are unfortunately they're just not designed for to last particularly long, and just the wear of time on them would wipe them out. This ESV Heritage and even the Zondervan NIV Compact Bible that I was looking at, both of those are the sort of Bible that they're going to be still very usable, 100 years from now if they're taken care of at all.
Sure. And looking at your Bible, if I were to be honest, I think that would be a great Bible. Like that's one that I would consider buying. But then at the same time, you know, I'm looking for something in a KJV or in a Geneva, and it's even harder there. I mean, it's nice because it's public domain and there's all sorts of companies making them, but those companies are not necessarily funded well enough to be putting together Bibles as nice as the one that you have there.
Right. And the funny thing is, you know, again, we were talking kind of first world problems with this. One of these is $125. The other one's $175. But if you get into real premium Bibles,
like calfskin or whatever.
Yeah, you get into like Allen Bibles or the high-end Cambridge Bibles. Those are wonderful. They're really nice in the hand. They really feel that one of the things that a premium binding will get you, and that I think the ESV has achieved at a much nicer price point, and the NIV to a lesser degree has achieved at a significant, I mean, $125 for a premium genuine leather bound Bible is actually very inexpensive. But you talk about, like, you know, Allen's and Cambridge and some of the other real high-end Bibles, and it's really easy to drop $250 to $350 on one of those, and which is just absolutely madness to me. Even the $175 Bible that I have sitting in front of me, it's kind of madness. I get that, and especially if we have people listening from, you know, people listening from India. You know, we have other people listening from around the world be like, you people are insane. But, well, frankly, the things are, Bibles like this are priced for their market too. And you have, if you go, like, for instance, when I was in India, I was able to purchase a really nice little NIV compact Bible. It was a bonded leather, but it was a really nice little one, that would cost probably $25-$30 here for, I think, $2 in India. So that's sure. The other thing too, is if the publishers are being, are using their funds in a missional way, they're also thinking in terms of how can they get quality bindings and quality Bibles to, people in, you know, second and third world regions that can't afford these premium prices, and they'll actually get better quality things than they could get by, helping by having the people that have more money help pay for the tooling and whatnot.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. So, shifting gears a little bit, there's been kind of an interesting movement in Bibles, you've probably seen them, the Reader's Bibles and the, we can talk about journaling Bibles maybe in another episode, but, since we're talking about Bible design, I thought it would be good to talk about, people are really trying to make an effort to apply solid design principles to Bibles and not think of them as Bibles anymore, but think of them as books. So they're trying to build, do you own one of these?
Yeah, I have actually several. Most of them are digital, but I do have a couple of print ones. One of them is, I have a cousin that works at Crossway, and for Christmas he got all of his cousins a reader's version of the Gospels. So it's actually a premium leather covered board, book of just the Gospels, and it's a reader's version. So it doesn't have any chapter, numbers or verse numbers in it. No cross references. It's just the text of the Bible.
And is, of course, it red letter or just all black?
It's black letter. Yeah. I really like it. Actually, it's really, really nice for reading. And I think it works really well there. I also have probably one of the best-known ones is the Bibliotheca Kickstarter project that happened about, it's coming up on 2 years ago now.
Yep.
And they, a guy named Adam Green was putting together this four-book Bible. So you'd have a Bible, but it would be in four, there'd be four pieces to it so that you could actually grab, you know, the New Testament, just grab that and have that with you. And all of it is a reader's Bible from, it's the whole Bible. It's, the American Standard Version. And he's then doing some modifications to,
yeah,
the American
updating
Standard
the language and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then again, no, chapter breaks, no verse breaks in it. It's just the book is the book. I hope that he handles the Psalms and Proverbs better than I've seen that handled. I have another reader's version where they took all the Psalms and Proverbs and didn't put any chapter or divisions in that either. And that made me a little bit crazy because it's like, you know, the Psalms are recognized. It's individual. It's kind of like saying, you know, here's a book of poetry, you know, by Tennyson, but we're not going to give you the titles of the different poems.
Right. They don't even have the superscriptions?
Yeah, they don't even have like a Psalm of David or...
Because those were in the original text. That's the funny thing.
Yeah. I think that particular reader's version, and this is not one of the ones I've mentioned. I'm not going to mention the title of it just because, but because I don't want to be dogging on them. I think the fact that they're putting out a reader's version is excellent, but just if you can... see if you can preview it and see if that works for you. But I think the concept of a reader's version is really excellent. It's actually something I've pushed for pretty aggressively with the Olive Tree Bible Software, which is where David and I work, to sometime in the future here, and it hasn't happened yet, but sometime in the future, come out with one where we can like flick a switch and say, I don't want to see cross references. I don't want to see notes. I don't want to see verse numbers and chapter numbers.
Sure. That's something I'm actually hoping to work on pretty soon here.
I think that would be awesome.
So yeah, this reader Bible thing is really interesting, and I know you're a big fan, and I wouldn't say that I'm not a fan, but I think that it's interesting because from an historical perspective, well, maybe I can talk a little bit about the nature of printing and Bibles. Like, for the longest time, the ability to write things down and the ability to transfer information in written form or in printed form was extremely, it was just a scarce thing. It was hard to transfer written information because paper was a limited thing. Not everybody could read. And then on top of that, you had to worry about, if one copy of something got lost, that was the end of it. So you wanted to be able to copy it as quickly as you possibly could. So for that reason, ancient languages often didn't have things like vowels or spaces. And so like in Hebrew, you would just kind of look at the text and go, okay, well, what happens if I put an O there? And reading was a lot more like deciphering some sort of code. Not quite that bad, but it was much more difficult.
Right, and I think it's more of a, isn't that more of a Greek thing than Hebrew?
Greek had the vowels, right? Like alpha.
Yeah, but I think for Hebrew, you're talking, isn't it like the name of the Lord where they just took out the vowels because they didn't want it pronounceable?
No, so the...
Why we're discussing this, I have no idea.
Well, it's Helvetic. We discuss theology and we discuss design. So
that's right. Yeah.
We're getting really into these original languages here. No, but as I understand it, Hebrew did not have vowels until the Masoretes added the vowel points, but that was close to the 11th century AD or the 9th century, somewhere around 1000 AD. Mm-hmm. And so now we have vowel points and everybody in seminary reads, you know, Hebrew with vowel points. But if you were to go over to Israel right now and look at a street sign, it's not going to have any vowel points. And I've been to Israel. I can confirm. So then furthermore, even in Greek, no spaces. So everything is just all butted up against each other. I remember we did a textual criticism class when I was at Bible college. And our job was to take 10 different copies of the same thing. And they all had subtle differences, and all of it was just all capital letters. And it was in English, but the exercise was, this is what textual criticism is like. You have to figure out where each word ends and each word begins. And then from looking, once you've done that for each of these manuscripts, you have to look at it and figure out which one or come out, you know, take multiple of them and combine them together and figure out what you think was most likely the original. And while I disagree with the some of the philosophy behind the textual criticism there, it was still a really good exercise because reading the Bible historically has not been an easy thing. Now, there were people in the church who could read the Bible and they could read it really well. And so you would go to church or you would get together with somebody and they would read it out loud, which is why I have a real appreciation for audio Bibles, because I think God's word was really meant to be listened to more so than anything else. Not to say that there's no value in reading. And again, I'm not trying to diss readers' Bibles, because that's a different way of reading the Bible historically, but that doesn't mean there's no value in it.
Right. Yeah. I think that at least one of the reasons that people are doing a reader's Bible or trying to get back to the reader's Bibles is because they said, you know, because of the, I mean, we know that there were not chapter breaks.
Sure.
We know they were not verse breaks, that those things came along later. Now, like I was saying before, in the instance of the Psalms and Proverbs, to a lesser degree, those did exist. The chapter breaks, at least, are from the very get-go, because they're, you know, it's, again, like I said, it's like different works of poetry. But they're trying to get back to that, get away from those artificial breaks,
right,
that happen in reading scripture. Sometimes you'll come to, you know, it's like I always think the Ephesians 5:20 and 5:21 is an interesting break. That's kind of an artificial break that happens where, if you recall, that's the area where it says, you know, submit to one another, in reverence to the Lord. And then it says, wives, submit to your husbands. And a lot of times people go, well, there's this break in the text here. Now we'll start at 5:21. Wives, submit to your husbands. And there isn't that mutual submission aspect that is clearly there in the text, but can be kind of lost due to artificial breaks that were added later.
Definitely. And that whole thing, I mean, working with Bibles, even if you're not doing the translation, but you're just doing the, like, I think when I was growing up, the NASB was our translation, and that's each verse gets its own paragraph translation. And proof texting was just something that was accepted that everybody did. Like this idea of, I can quote one verse out of context and that proves my point, right? Whereas right. Now I go to a church that uses the ESV and everything is very much more focused on biblical theology. I would say almost to a fault, like to the point where, you know, everything needs to be read in context, even if it's pretty obvious what the verse is saying. I don't want to fault my church or anything for that, but it's just very interesting how you see these different emphases, and you have to wonder which came first, the chicken or the egg. Did we decide, that we don't want to take verses out of context, and so we use a paragraph translation, or did we decide not to take verses out of context because of the way that we were reading our Bible, you know, Monday through Friday in the morning?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's that's an interesting philosophical discussion that's definitely worthy of continuing.
Definitely. And so for me, when I think about trying to design a reader's Bible, because that's something that I actually maybe 3 or 4 years ago was considering, back when all of these were starting to get popular, I was like, oh, that's something that I could do, or I could just take like the ASV or whatever and create not a new translation, but a new kind of Bible. And I was thinking about how historically the people of God have read the scriptures, and it's always been this slow, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to decipher this thing. And now I'm trying to make it happen as quickly as possible. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but I want people to understand there's a time for reading the Bible quickly just to get it into your head so that you can meditate on it, you know, throughout the day. But then there's also a time for reading the Bible very slowly and studying each individual word and really just meditating in the moment with the text in front of you.
Yeah, I can appreciate that for sure. I think the other thing with the Reader's Bible is that it doesn't necessarily mean it's as reading as fast as you can, but what I have found when I'm reading from a Reader's Bible is I don't necessarily, I stop at the end of
a thought,
or the end of a particular, you know, like a, like at the end of one of the parables or things like
right.
that. And it's, I find it's interesting to note where I stop as I'm reading if I don't have those external breaks there for me, versus where I read when I've got all the book chapter and verse divisions. Of course, book divisions are there, but the
sure.
chapter and verse divisions.
Sure.
So I think, again, I think I really like the idea of a reader's Bible. I think the most challenging thing for a reader's Bible for me personally is just trying to use that in the context of a Bible study or, you know, with other people around. It's like, turn to, you know, that part in Galatians where, okay,
about
where
halfway
Paul is,
through, yeah. right after the paragraph where he says.
Right, yeah, exactly. So it's very difficult to clarify that. And actually, I've run into that before because I did a study through Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology. Everybody else had printed books, and I had a Bible Reader with me, or Olive Tree's Bible Plus app with me, with Wayne Grudem in there. And it was very difficult for us to know that we were looking at the same area at the same time. So there's some advantages certainly with a book chapter and verse divisions as far as that goes too, to make sure we're all looking at the same thing, especially when we don't have the exact same printed version in front of us.
Sure. Sure. So yeah, I guess maybe something that we could suggest here, before we wrap this up, is that when you're thinking about a Bible, you really need to think about the purpose, because as designers, when we're designing Bibles and designing even Bible apps, we're thinking, we want to make this Bible for somebody who wants to do this thing with it. And reader's Bibles are intended for your daily reading. They're not really intended, like you were saying, they're not really intended for you to take to a Bible study and to try to interact with everybody else there, because the verse numbers are there specifically for that, you know, for that idea.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And then, you know, if you're doing verse memorization, verses are really helpful there. If most of the time you feel like, you know, I've read through the Bible like 15 times, but I really need to study it, then, you know, maybe a study Bible is going to be better for you. But to really think about, and you know, we're in an age now where I can't imagine anybody not being able to justify owning a couple of Bibles, at least, you know, maybe you've got a study Bible and a reader's Bible or that kind of thing.
At least certainly here in the West.
Yeah. And I don't think our audience is probably substantially international at this point.
Hi, Mom.
So yeah, I guess the biggest thing that we can take away from here is think about why you're using the translation you're using and use the right translation for the right job. And also I would encourage listen to the Bible, listen to it being read, because I think if we're thinking of God as a designer, he designed the Bible to be read out loud. And that's why when the KJV was released, it was authorized for public reading. That was something that they were very concerned with. And we can praise God that now everybody can read, at least here in the West. Like most people are able to just open up a Bible and read, and that's beautiful. And that gives us certain responsibilities. But we shouldn't neglect the other means of receiving God's word that he's given us, like going to church and hearing it read, or listening to, I think James Earl Jones has a right reading of the KJV, which I can't recommend, although it's awesome.
Yeah. And there's some great apps out there too, that do spoken Bibles. The Bible Gateway app, has audio Bibles in tons of languages, actually. I think Bible.is is another really excellent audio Bible app. It's their primary focus. And they're doing some amazing things where they're trying to get the Bible out to the unreached as far as they can. And they're really pretty awesome in how they're pursuing that. So,
Sure. So you just recommended something. Why don't we go ahead and jump into our recommendations section if we're done with that topic.
Sure.
Do you have anything you would like to recommend to our listeners at home, maybe unrelated to what we were just talking about?
Yeah. One of the things that I was pursuing here is over Christmas, I was also able to buy an iPad 2, a used one that's in perfect shape.
iPad Air 2, right?
iPad Air 2. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, I was able to buy one of those over Christmas, and I kind of thought of it as a less expensive way of getting into a Cintiq-like drawing experience. If you're not familiar with that, a Wacom Cintiq is a drawing tablet that also has a computer screen built into it, so you're drawing directly on the screen in front of you. In fact, some of them now actually are a full-fledged computer you can take separately and draw on. They're wonderful, but they are very expensive. They start around $1,000.
And that's for a really small one.
And that's for a really small one. Yeah, they go up exponentially from there. Anyway, so I have this iPad 2, and I was looking iPad Air 2, and I was looking for a good way to do drawing on that iPad Air 2. And I've gone through multiple different styluses or styli trying to get a good result there. And so two that I've settled on are the Edonit Jot Pro, which is a capacitive stylus, meaning it doesn't have a battery, it doesn't have anything that needs to be charged or connected via Bluetooth or anything like that. And I also have the Pencil by 53. I like both of these. I actually think I prefer the cheaper one, the Edonit Jot Pro, reason being that the rubber, the resistance, the drag on the screen of the rubber tip kind of drives me a little bit nuts, and also the fatness of that rubber tip. You can't see what's happening underneath it.
Sure.
But there's some really neat advantages to having the Pencil as well, because you have palm rejection where it can notice that your palm is there. I'm left-handed, so my palm is all over that screen when I'm trying to draw. And it also has a degree of kind of understanding whether the pencil is straight up and down or on its side. So if it's kind of on its side, it does have a fatter line. And then it also has an eraser if you're using the actual pencil, Is it Pencil by 53 app?
Oh, it's the paper app, yeah.
Paper by 53, right. If you're using the actual paper app, then you have you have a smudging ability. So you can draw on there, and then you can actually put your finger on the screen and smudge. It'll just smudge it. It won't draw with the finger once that's connected. So it's really a neat device, but I think the simpler, as simple as I can get, is my favorite. So at this point, my favorite stylus is the Edonit Jot Pro, but I'm still looking for something that actually does pressure sensitivity.
Yeah, and that's hard with the, because the iPad Air 2 doesn't have the, it doesn't have a screen that's designed for that. So whatever you're using for an input, it's not going to be too much more precise than a finger, because that's what the iPad's expecting.
Right, yeah.
So for my recommendation, I recently bought an Amazon gift card that I was given for Christmas. I bought a Color Monkey Smile. which, as I say it out loud, makes me almost regret buying it.
Amen.
But the it's a color calibration tool for your monitor, and I have a Monoprice monitor here. It's their 27-inch glass one. It's their attempt to knock off the Apple Thunderbolt display, Cinema Thunderbolt, whatever they call it.
Right.
And it's a really nice monitor, but when I tried to self-calibrate it, I found that it was pretty hard. So I picked this thing up. I got it on Amazon for about $70, and I just plugged it in and ran the software that I had to download it, or, you know, use the CD, plugged it in, installed it, ran the thing, and now my color is perfect. And evidently you can use third-party apps with it if you're finding that the built-in software is not giving you the results that you were hoping for. So I didn't end up needing to do that. I can't really speak to that. But for $70, you can turn any decent, you know, half decent IPS display into something that really rivals the Apple Thunderbolt or the higher end monitors out there.
Right. And about how much was that Monoprice monitor when you purchased it?
I want to say I got it for $375.
Yeah. And then the Thunderbolt monitor is $1,000. So,
yeah.
You can see the advantage of being able to do something like that. And it's a good looking monitor. It's actually a real nice monitor.
Yeah. And I have also from Monoprice, I have the monitor arm, from Monoprice as well. Which is pretty nice. And that thing was only, I think that was $15 for a monitor arm that holds a 27-inch monitor.
Holy
so,
cow.
Yeah, you can really do, you can, like, if you're sitting at home thinking, man, the best I can do is go buy a TN panel or what, you know, a Twisted-O-Matic cheap monitor or whatever, you can get pretty far. And I mean, I bought a 27-inch monitor, but there are lots of IPS monitors out there for, you know, $80-$100 for a 22-inch.
Yeah, you get 22-23 inch is a lot less expensive than a 27-inch. And it provides a significant percentage of the screen real estate there.
Yeah, and then you just load a you grab a Color Monkey and grab a calibrator tool, and this was the cheapest one. Like, right. They didn't make them cheaper than this, but you really don't need to spend more. This will work on multiple monitors, multiple computers. My wife's going to use it here pretty soon on her computer. So yeah, definitely recommend that. It really makes a difference to have good color accuracy. I remember I was working on a design the other day before I got this thing. And I looked at it on my iPad because I was just looking and thinking, wow, there's a big difference between what my iPad is showing, which is 100% sRGB accurate, and what my monitor is showing. So now there's no difference.
Right. Yeah, no, that can be a huge difference. The other thing, too, I've noticed with the iPad, at least on some of the projects I've worked on, is if you're doing a PDF, it's important to get the Adobe PDF Reader software. And it's available in the App Store for free.
Oh, yeah, because of the CMYK to RGB conversion and all that.
Yeah, because Apple's preview software can sometimes really mess up the look of things.
So those are our recommendations. If you guys have recommendations, we would love to hear them. You can actually call us. We have a voicemail line set up, so you can call 707-99-TULIP. Get it? Because we're Reformed Theology. A joke, and flowers are pretty. They're well designed.
Yeah.
So 707-99-TULIP, and let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what you recommend, what things you might recommend. Maybe you don't like the Color Monkey smile. Maybe you have a stylist suggestion for Joe. He would love to hear that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, do that, and also tell your friends. Tell your friends about this show. You probably have friends. If you're a designer, you probably have designer friends. You get together, you talk about fonts and make everybody else feel awkward. Tell them about this show. And then you'll have something else to make your other friends feel awkward about while you discuss it.
Yeah. Like, for instance, I told my friend about this show and he said, we're doing the show together. Why are you telling me about this?
That was me, Joe.
Oh, right. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful whatever time of day it is for you.
Yep. Thanks, and bye-bye.